you know, we're going to all move in front of City Hall and start camping there and protest. It's just not safe to be in the other parks and so on. And we're going to do a tent city protest. And so at the end of the lunch, we had a little meeting, and we said we should just set up a field kitchen in front of City Hall. So we already had all the equipment there, tent and all the stuff that the city had made us get to get this permit for the first time. So we just moved everything over to in front of City Hall and started a 24-hour-a-day soup kitchen. And that was unbelievable. And we were there. The city decided not to pick up trash because they wanted to look like homeless people are trashy. So we had to set up our own garbage collection every day. We had these meals 24 hours a day. At noon, when everybody come out of City Hall, we'd have like a rally or theater, or these people there made a ballet and stuff like that. We had all kinds of signs, and then ultimately it was like maybe as many as 500 people living in front of the park. And it was, you know, that was the front page of the paper every day for the Examiner and the Chronicle. The opening story of the news for 27 days was this crisis in front of City Hall. And at one point we occupied the mayor's office. There's like a photo in the book of us with a big banner like that hanging off the mayor's balcony. And to get rid of us, the mayor decided what he would do is to open a shelter down the street. So there's an abandoned building like two blocks away. And so he made an announcement, okay, we have housing for the homeless now. There's a shelter down the street. And the good homeless will be in the shelter, and the bad homeless will be arrested. And so that gave them the pretext to attack us on that 27th day, and they brought all these riot police and swept the area. But by now, we had been serving food 24 hours a day, so we decided to do lunch and dinner for every day in front of City Hall, plus our Monday meal. And so we did that for many, many years. And, every day what would happen after that was the cops were going to try to get rid of us completely. So we would be arrested and many times beaten at the lunch and the dinner. And there was a lot of people came to eat. And so it wasn't too long before we figured out, in fact, probably I think it was only like the first time when they took all the food, we realized what we do is we divide up the food into thirds. So we would have like a little a bucket with just a little bit of soup and maybe a loaf of bread and a couple of cups and stuff. And two or three people would set up and they would serve one or two people and the police would arrest them. And then we would have another little bit of food, you know, maybe two or three loaves of bread and a little bit more soup and more salad, that stuff. But just small, relatively, you know, enough to feed like six or seven people before you get arrested. You know, we figure out how many people you could serve before you get arrested, and we bring that much food. So we do that, and once they made the second group of arrests, then we would come in with enough food for all the people that arrived to eat. And that would be very uplifting to the people that came to eat, that it wasn't about, because they were trying to say it was just about us getting publicity and being famous and blah, blah, blah. But we actually would get food to people. And we built this very tight bond because every day the homeless are being arrested all the time. Now the people feeding the homeless are being arrested all the time. You know, there was like this, and we had come out there to stay there for 27 days in solidarity with them. And we were sleeping in the park with them all that time and stuff. It was like a heavy scene. And that went on for, like basically for the rest of the summer. That all happened during the tent city was at the time of Tiananmen Square. In China. All that was parallel, and the police spread a rumor that there was also a tent city in Tompkins Square Park at that same time. Everybody's going, oh, the police opened fire on the tent city in Tompkins Square Park. They might do that here. They tried all kinds of techniques. They gave away free speed to everybody. If cops were out there giving away speed, that like freaked out a bunch of people because they were totally a mess in that. They did everything. And they even the newspapers made T-shirts that said Camp Agnos and handed out. The newspapers gave free stuff to this homeless guys to be the official spokespeople for the park. Told them what to say. Gave them T-shirts that said Camp Agnos to attack the mayor, because we weren't really about attacking the mayor. We were about attacking the system. And then the reporters would interview the people that they had set up and get the right story from the homeless to coincide with the... It was just amazing to see the multiplicity of scams that was happening around this issue. As you can see, like every trick in the book. So then we're doing this all the time, and then suddenly, October 5th, there's this huge earthquake, and the electricity and the power, gas go off, and we're cooking in this apartment, and we were supposed to go down at 6 o'clock to serve, and the earthquake was at 5, and we said, well, we got propane tanks and stuff, and you know, let's collect up all of our equipment, and we'll just finish cooking the food down at Center Plaza, because it's unlikely that the cops are going to be busting us now since there's this huge earthquake. So we set up this field kitchen, and lo and behold, all these people started coming there to eat, more than the regular people we were already feeding, including the police. And the police just stood in line patiently with everybody else to get their dinner. And that ended those arrests. And we were the only food program in San Francisco for the first 3 days after the earthquake. Because Salvation Army and Red Cross, they all depended on electricity and the gas to operate. And we got all this food from walk-in refrigerators and stuff. It was just a mind-blower. And it's quite a scene. It was a very, very cool experience. And it showed that we, you know, Funan Bonds could be there in a crisis where peace actually was given money by the Red Cross. Since peace could do it, Red Cross, no, but it was very active. Saved the day. So that ended the arrest, and that mayor never did any more arrests. And then another mayor ran for this other guy, the chief of police. The chief of police that had been arrested all these years, named Frank Jordan, and he had this. His campaign was he was going to be tough on the homeless because the mayor before would not be tough on the homeless, and he came up with this program, which probably some social scientists called the Quality of Life Enforcement Matrix Program. And in his campaign speeches, he said what he was going to do is build a work camp south of town in San Mateo County, and he would even have Work Shall Make You Free on the entrance, and he was trying to, you know, connect with his supporters. And they would have this comprehensive plan to force the homeless out of the city. And that became the plan that Rudy Giuliani and this so famous Frank Jordan from San Francisco. He became like kind of he would go off to Moscow to teach him how to take care of the homeless. And you know, went to all the cities to show. And so the program had personal belongings into garbage trucks. You know, they got psychiatrists that are like taking people away to mental hospitals. They, you know, they had, it was really, really intense. They had this wasn't in the video, but they had actually got helicopters from the Clinton administration, and they would fly over with thermal imaging devices to see the heat coming off the bodies and the sleeping bags and the parks and stuff. That way they could send a team out to grab them and pull them in. And so it was a matrix of social services or matrix of departments. And the public works department would come. They had special Hondas that could be set up like a jail. So they would come in and circle a group of homeless people, and you couldn't leave because you'd be enclosed by the Honda motorcycles. and all those people would be ID'd and many of them arrested and taken away. And it was quite an intense campaign. So we immediately got arrested supporting the people in the parks, and we'd been organizing against this campaign, having rallies and stuff like that. And we then almost immediately got an injunction. First, they got an injunction against me, and then we beat it in court. Then they got like a permanent injunction against anyone serving free food or transporting food for the purposes of giving away free food or any of those kinds of things. And so the arrest started becoming felony conspiracy to serve food and violation of a court order. So that meant you had to stay the night no matter what. If you were arrested, you had to stay the night in jail. And very shortly, this one man, Tom Osher, had this idea to invite your group to come and serve free food and risk arrest one day a month. So we got like all these groups, the other political groups, they would come and they'd have their banner and they'd get arrested. We had some unions that came and they would have their banner and they would serve food and get arrested. We had these nuns and priests and rabbis to come out and serve food and get arrested. And they actually started a group out because of this called Religious Witness with Homeless People. And we had, then the National Lawyers Guild came out and they had their banner and they served food. And the police came and arrested the people eating. They did not arrest the lawyers. So it's funny seeing the priests being frisked down and everything by the cops before they get put in the car and stuff. And there was some really heavy-duty violence that happened during that time. And we had, it was a very intense experience. And I got framed on the California Three Strikes Law and faced life in prison and had a series of really big rallies around that and spent quite a bit of time in jail through this whole thing, waiting for trial. And my bail started out like at some really, they tried to get like a $500,000 bail, but my lawyer talked him down to $250,000 and stuff. And it was insane. And there was these huge actions that went on. And also at that same time, now there's all these Food Not Bombs groups that are starting all over the country. It's like unbelievable. And in solidarity with Native Americans who were protesting the 500th anniversary of Europeans coming to the New World. And so we had 2 or 3 days like what we're doing here, and then we were amazed. You know, there were people from Vancouver, and we had Boston, and you know, it was like what it was just we were freaked out. We couldn't believe so many people were at this thing.
It was actually very similar to this gathering.
Yeah.
Now that you mention it.
Yeah.
Similar kind of space.
Yeah, the photos would look just the same as this. Yeah, it was too funny.
Actually, oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's the same shape of room, same number of people, and basically the same number of people coming from different cities in the world. And so that was really fun. And some of the Food Not Bombs kids stole the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria floats during the middle of the parade. And
that wasn't a good idea,
but that became the talk of the. And people realized that was like a mistake. They were getting beaten up
by.
Lucky
they survived.
Yeah.
They killed.
Yeah, the people in the parade like flipped out, and but it was overall it was a very very good. We pushed Columbus out. The Indians, the Native Americans, actually, when Columbus arrived, put him just went back into the water and just pushed him back.
That was good.
You were there. Yeah, we were all there. We told them, "Hey, push him back, man! Don't let him in." It was too funny, and they go, "Oh, that's a good idea." So, it was around that time too that at one point I called there's this thing called the Bay City News Service, which is like a Associated Press or Reuters, but just for newspapers and media, for local media in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I call them up saying, okay, today at noon we're going to be switching press. Angry at the other cops. It was funny. And then there also through this period, there's a big fountain in front of City Hall. And so they drained this fountain. I'm not sure why. So we would like set all of our equipment, hide our stuff in the fountain and serve from there. So then they go, that makes us really mad. So we'll flood the fountain. So they filled it, thinking that would get rid of us. So then we just would stand in the fountain and serve from inside, and they wouldn't climb in the fountain and get their shoes wet. And that, like, put them in a standoff for, like, about 2 months. It was, like, funny. And you can imagine the logistics that we went through. We had to hide the food. We'd hide food, camouflage it. You know, you had to, like, switch it from one car to another. It was like we were, like, major drug dealers or something. Like that. It was unbelievable, but we're just trying to get food to City Hall. And we would bring out empty buckets, and they'd arrest the people, and there'd be nothing in the buckets. But they didn't care. They'd just take them away anyway. And
we have that
video. Yeah, we have that. It's funny. So, and then now Food Not Bombed. So because of this media whiteout, we decided we have friend Stephen Dunifer, who was really interested in pirate radio stuff. And so we said, we need some pirate radios. And so he just started, like, building transmitters. And so we did this experiment. You know, we made two transmitters. And actually, another friend of ours in San Francisco built one of the transmitters. Steve built the other one. And Steve was helping. And then we started broadcasting free radio just from the tops of the hills. And to get the news out, that became really significant and important for the bombs too, because now the media couldn't twist stories. We had the news all the time out there, and so we ran those two stations eventually. We were doing, like, I don't know if we were doing 24 hours a day, but we were doing, it might be 24 hours a day after a while. We taped, and it was just remarkable. And then we developed this thing called the Food Not Bombed Radio Network. And this is before internet, so there's a lot of funny things that happened before internet, and that I think are silly now, as we have it. Like, for instance, one of our first protests in Cambridge, the collective, we knew that there was a huge protest in Germany against the Pershing missile. But we didn't really know the extent of it. A million people did civil disobedience in Europe. It was like, including judges and stuff, to get the U.S. to get Pershing missiles out. So we did something in solidarity in Cambridge, and then to find out about it, we dialed, they used to have these things called international operators, which I don't even think they have that anymore.
Well,
but
it was information.
Yeah, you called up, you used to be able to call, like, 411?
Before that.
Yeah, something like that. You call, or zero, yeah. You call, and you talk, and say, we want an operator in Germany. And they put us through, and we talked to an operator in Germany and say, hey, tell us about the protests in Germany. And then we spent the whole...
German who could speak English.
Right.
That was, the operator was answering the phone, was that.
Yeah, until we found like a few operators that actually told us the what was up. And we told them to call the, can you call the organizers and tell them we did one here in Cambridge? But
and we spent, and there's a time difference, that would be like 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock in the morning, we'd be talking to them, getting information, and we would talk for 40, 25 minutes, just once we would talk.
For free.
Yeah. It was also it was a free call. So that was really...
Yeah, so then we ended up, back to the original story, we had this radio network. So now, of course, you would make a sound file and email it, or just put it up on the web. But then we actually taped all these cassettes. We'd mix this whole show, and we had all kinds of... We had this one program that was on...
What's that called?
What?
Go ahead.
Okay, well, we had this... we had a cat. You could order... You know, we had subscribers from, like, different community radio stations around the U.S., and they pay, like, a certain amount of money. And we'd send you the monthly tape with our show that was 30 minutes pre-recorded. They'd broadcast it. And one of the things that we discovered was that in our research that the elections are an unregulated activity. The people, the election, the voting machines and all that stuff was in San Francisco run by Pacific Lumber. The same company that owned Pacific Lumber owned the voting machines. So, you know, we uncovered like all this voting fraud stuff. And we had like really cool shows. And so we were doing all that at that time. And we also, because the arrests were getting so intense, we said we need to be putting some more pressure on the city to try to end these arrests. And so we came up with this idea of homes, not jails. So what we would do is, at the beginning of homes, not jails, we found that this a couple of abandoned buildings, one in near where we're sharing food, and there was also a famous hotel that was abandoned, and the guy was supposed to go to jail because it was technically illegal for him to evict everybody from the hotel to make it a luxury hotel, and a jailable offense, but they were just letting him slide because he's a rich dude. And that hotel was across the street from the main soup kitchen in town where the mayor would come every Thanksgiving to cut turkey and show how he's a good guy for the homeless. So what we did, we took over 3 buildings the night before Thanksgiving, 2 of them that we planned to keep secret and have people live in, and then this hotel. And so when the mayor came to cut the turkey, we just unfurled all these banners out of the windows and everything, and then the police had a siege around that building. And the meantime, while we were on the talking to the media, we would say, yeah, but we got 2 other buildings that you don't know about where we are housing homeless, so ha ha ha, you know. And so then with that, we eventually got a team that was really organized, and we got I was just reading in a book about this called No Trespassing. I think it was like 400 houses we had keys to, because we'd find in the and in San Francisco, that's pretty remarkable, the 400 abandoned buildings. But we go to the city hall and find the buildings that were being fought over between 2 banks, because one mortgage would be bought out by another mortgage, but then there'd be like some crisis in the transaction because the savings and loan scandal was happening at the time. So we would go and get into the buildings and put our own locks on them. And at night, when people were eating dinner, we'd go to a family or something and say, hey, do you want a place to live? And they say, oh, yeah, sure, we'd love a place to live, you know. It's free, you know, no problem. And they say, oh, yeah. So meet us at this address at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. They would show up, or we would meet them someplace and take them there if they didn't seem like they would have their act together to get there. And we would have hard hats and with tool belts and stuff like that. And we would open the door right at 9 o'clock, like who squats at 9 in the morning, and we'd start painting the outside of the house and looking like we're working, you know, like construction workers working for the landlord, and move the people right in. And so we had like really interesting experiences with that, with housing people throughout the city. And then we did these public actions where we would be trying to put political pressure on the mayor to stop harassing us and stop harassing the homeless. So that era kind of evolved into so many. Well, we had then another gathering, which was in 1995. That was the 50th anniversary of the founding of the United Nations. And we were serving at UM Plaza at this time. For whatever reasons, we moved from City Hall I remember the reason. There was the supervisors voted to let us serve free food, and the only piece of land that they controlled was UN Plaza, and everything else was under the jurisdiction of the mayor. So we moved to UN Plaza, and even though we kept getting the supervisors to vote to support us, the cops still busted us. And then, with the 50th anniversary of the United Nations, we knew that they were going to have this huge celebration. People from all over the world would be in San Francisco, and they were going to dedicate a monument to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights at UN Plaza, of which one of the rights is the right to food, and another right is the right to protest and assembly. So we contacted the United Nations and got cases of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights to hand out. We put out the word about this gathering maybe like 1 year in advance. I think it was like pretty much 1 year in advance. And started organizing for this, and we had to do, we had email by then, so there was an attempt to use email a little bit to try to bring in groups to help make decisions in other cities and stuff, and but not too many people had that at that time. And we got this 10-day gathering going in San Francisco, which started out with a tent city protest, which was promptly busted, and we had our own radio station for the gathering itself, just the Funabomb's gathering radio station. We had like a little newspaper we put out, that's sort of like this one that has been here for the conversions, and we were really shocked to find that roughly 600 people showed up for this gathering. It was huge. And we had workshops, like the ones that we have here. We had cooking workshops, cooking workshops, locking workshops, workshops, gender issues, racism issues, consensus. All kinds of workshops. While 3 times a day, we were arrested and organizing marches. One day was like, we'd have themes for each day about issues, and we were coalesced with the other actors. And the final day of protest was the actual day of the big celebration of the UN. We had a torchlight march in the city, and 278 of us were arrested for felony arson, largest arson arrest in U.S. history. And pirate radio came into play there because of the there was a we actually have copies of the press releases by the police and everything. They put out all this misinformation right away. You know, they basically write the press release while we're organizing the action, so they're like kind of moving parallel. And but because of free radio, the media had to change the story about this actually trying to burn buildings and stuff. Say, so, yeah, well, actually, they weren't ATOMs. Days for people, and the cops captured me one time and took me to police intelligence, and they had like the chairs like this, and all the cops sat there, and they go, what are you doing? We ID these people, and their IDs are from all over the world. You know, what's going on? What are you doing to us? You know, we don't mean, you know, our bosses are making us arrest you. What are you, you know, it's like this early Sunday morning thing where they were freaking out. They didn't know how we could be doing this at this extent.
And again, in terms of the theme of how looking back things seem plain, the radio station that you mentioned, just kind of glossed over that we had a radio station for the gathering, the significance of that AM radio station that was like 5 watts, that was in an office building a couple blocks down from where we were actually, UN Plaza, where we were actually feeding people. Because the lunch and dinner for the 600 people that came to the gathering was in UN Plaza.
Speaking of,
and
That's a cue. We planned that. Busted immediately, but we moved it to a different place so they could find it. Because like, we were running it out of the office, you know. We're a little bowl.
So evicted immediately.
Yeah, we were evicted the first day we rented this office. But then we stayed for the whole conference gathering because, you know, you get 30 days. So that's the way it was. We didn't care. We were only renting it for 30 days. But, so that was, really took Funov Bombs off into another dimension. And because I was on probation from these three strike things, I started organizing a lot of tours. And we did like a tour called Funov Bombs, which was maybe like 30 cities in the U.S. And then we did another tour called Rentis Theft, where we broadcast the presentation on a pirate radio that we took with us. I dressed in a chef's hat and did a food demonstration making tofu spread sandwiches. And I'd be making the tofu spread telling you the history of Funov Bombs, which at that time was much shorter. And then and then I would, plus I'd tell you how to make the tofu spread. And then it would all be broadcast and we show the video of Funov Bombs creating tears. I did one tour in Europe. It was one of the San Francisco Funov Bombs kids was from Germany, so he like invited me over, went around. Then we met some, and during the Three Strikes thing, there was a rally in Berlin, and this man in Berlin, oh my goodness, connected with heard about my case in this cafe, and he organized a translation of the Funov Bombs book into Spanish, and he invited me on a tour of Spain. So I went on a tour of Spain, and in exchange, we organized a tour in North America for him and two other people. The economy, and they were working against globalization at that time. That had been in 95, and at that 95. So in 1996, we went to 60 cities in North America. And right off in the first meetings in San Francisco and Baltimore where they talked about organizing against the globalization of the economy and so on, it was very new in the United States. There was NAFTA, but we hadn't, you know, people didn't know about WTO very much or IMF World Bank stuff. And we said, they explained what was going on in Europe and what they did in Europe, and we said, oh yeah, we should shut down the WTO if it ever comes to North America. Well, everyone should go there and blockade it. Don't let the delegates in. And we had no idea where that would be, but we went around on this tour, and we'd have a question-and-answer period and talk about strategies at the end. And if they come to North America, we will try to shut them down. And about a year later, they announced they were going to be having the WTO in Seattle. And we had worked with – we tried to get Global Exchange – the International Forum on Globalization and Council of Canadians to sponsor this tour with us, but because we were Food Not Bombs or whatever, they were like, ah, well, that's fine. So they didn't ever go with us, but of course they became pretty involved in the in this action. And Food Not Bombs, of course, served at this Battle of Seattle, and a huge number of people there were Food Not Bombs people, and we had free radio there for it and all that kind of stuff. And that's supposedly the start of the anti-globalization movement. Well, of course it's not, but that's what Western U.S. media says. So we actually were, essentially behind that idea, totally by accident in a sense, you know.
But. Well, yeah, it's about getting credit for what we did. Behind the scenes, they heard that I was living in Washington, D.C., and I was one of the people that started it, so they called me up, and the first time I talked to her, she was really excited. It was a really great story, and I was just trying to tell her the larger picture, and told her that she was a network, and she's actually calling back, and she never did, and I finally called her just to find out what happened, and she said that when she'd done some research and called other places where there was supposedly Food Not Bombs groups, she found that each one of them was just like the three teenagers that she had met that were friends of her family, friends of her friends, kids, that were just little groups that just sort of did this spontaneously all over the place. And she didn't understand that had any significance because to her, an organization has leaders and rules and budgets and plans, and Food Not Bombs never has anything like that, ever. No chap you ever meet has anything like that. And so for her, that would meant we were insignificant. Was not anything important. So she
nixed
the story. She didn't do it.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah,
there's a fascinating thing. And yet, Food Not Bombs is huge. In fact, I mean, what we've done, not just Pete and I personally, although what we've done personally is pretty amazing, because we really did do that tour 2 years before the Battle of Seattle, where we were educating people about these issues. We really did that. But there's books about the Battle of Seattle that don't mention Food Not Bombs.
Yeah, no, like, there's not a book about the Battle of Seattle that has the word Food Not Bombs in it ever. Even...
weird.
Which is kind of strange, considering
there were people there that were doing it.
Right. We were feeding. We were the kitchen at the Convergence Center, and we did 2 years, 3 years of organizing for it, but we weren't mentioned.
So it's weird.
And I get review copies all the time of books about the Battle of Seattle to review. I read them thoroughly, never see the word for nut bombs in them ever, or any mention of what's going on with it. It's very strange. But it's kind of cool in a way, because nonetheless... because of that, we don't have like this kind of weird high profile and kind of crazy scene going on that's typical of modern U.S. culture in particular. And most recently, I ended up I became seriously ill and lost my job as a result. And I was at the same time happened to be corresponding with this woman in Australia who had discovered that there was not only a bombs, but there was a Sydney food bombs. And she went, oh my goodness. And she saw it like, wow, there's not only a Sydney and a Melbourne food bombs, there's food bombs all over the world. So she's going to wants to do a documentary about food bombs around the world. And I was so together we like raised money, and some of you met her. Her name is Liz, and I visited like Boston, you know, Boston, cities, and interviewed people. And then we went to the Middle East, and we would she got away. The very first stop was Zagreb. So she got to Zagreb and she's wandering around the street saying, trying to find a place to stay and stuff, and asking if they know of where Funa Bombs is. And sure enough, within the first evening, she finds somebody that, oh yeah, Funa Bombs lives over here. Just go over to this house. And so she ends up crashing with Funa Bombs in Zagreb, and she frantically emails me, hey, they're serving food on Wednesday here. Come back. And so then I rush back on Wednesday. I serve food Saturday in Budapest and then rush back to Zagreb to serve food on Wednesday. And it's like, there's 6 chapters in Croatia. I'm like, wow, I was shocked there's even Zagreb. And then they start telling me, oh, yeah, there's, Herzegovina, and there's, like, Bosnia-Herzegovina. There's 2 Funa bombs there. There's a couple in Serbia. There's a Romanian Funa bombs. You know, so all of a sudden, all these groups that I didn't know existed came up, and everybody wants to go visit them there. And then in another case is I get to Ireland, and we know that there's a Belfast and a Dublin food not bombs, but it turns out there's like 6 in Ireland, 6 other cities in Ireland that have food not bombs chapters at least. And then we got to went to Poland, and it was 12 cities in Poland have food not bombs. And then they're turning this on to Belarus food not bombs and to groups further east. And
Germany, they've already had, I think, 2 national gatherings of food not bombs chapters.
Yeah.
There's enough chapters in Germany to have a national gathering.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, and then, we went to. Yeah, it was amazing. Well, there was like so many Funa bombs in Europe, and it was, we couldn't believe how many there were. You know, there's like 11 in Finland. There's like 7 cities in Sweden with them. The Danish Funa bombs had won the Danish. The Denmark Peace Award, and they had to stop the media from contacting them because they were like, all they were doing was the media. They couldn't cook and serve. And they were like on every talk show and everything for like weeks. Then we got to, we went to Bratislava Food Not Bombs in Slovakia. And because we'd passed through Bratislava, and they actually didn't get their email until the day we had just gone past them on the train, and they go, oh my God, you're supposed to be here tonight. We didn't know. Oh no, we didn't answer our email for like 3 months. Very sorry. You know, we're just lame. And so then we organized like we say, okay, we're going to go back. We've been talked into going back to Zagreb because it was such a wonderful time and so on. So we say, okay, we're going to be back in Zagreb on this day, and we're going to go to this action in Belgrade on this other day. So like, you know, yeah, we'll do it on this day. We told, you know, we only gave them like a 3 days notice. And we got there. There was 150 people showed up to see us speak. And there was we had been on national news, both the radio and TV, the day before. We were that day. And they did a huge special the day after. And we discovered that they had started animal rescue shelters, Bratislava Food Not Bombs, and well, there's groups in all the cities in Slovakia. They started animal rescue shelters in 24 cities. So it just depended on where you were and what the people thought should be happening. It was just unbelievable that people, particularly the further east you went, the more they thought Food Not Bombs was a part of totally transforming society and that it would be happening shortly, and they were just going to keep building and building and building. And we got to Turkey, and we started organizing Food Not Bombs groups there. And then there's like 6 cities in Turkey now that have Food Not Bombs chapters. We went to Israel, And we tried to start a Jerusalem food not bombs. There was already really active Tel Aviv food not bombs, who has also been, they feed people at checkpoints coming in from Palestine into the, or from the West Bank coming into Israel. And they serve every Thursday in Tel Aviv to mostly Russians and people that are homeless and living in Tel Aviv. And then they organize this thing called Anarchists Against the Wall. And they did these very, very militant actions there. And they were basically, Food Not Bombs kids were in the West Bank organizing every single day. And they took me to meet farmers. And they, the Food Not Bombs and this group of Palestinians set up a peace camp at one point. It was like amazing what's going on in the world with Food Not Bombs. It was like, whew. And then as you is anybody here from Australia? Yeah. Didn't you guys do like thing at Camp Baxter, and you were like had a huge, they saw great photos of that. And I don't know if you guys, did you free refugees or something like that? I've got stories that, yeah. Stuff like that. It's like everywhere you go, there's like the stuff in Malaysia that's going on. It's like, in Indonesia, Hong Kong food not bombs got busted like right off when the Chinese government took over Hong Kong. That's, and every, basically answering the, having the foodnotbombs.net, which I help maintain, and an 800 number in Tucson, I get contacts from, you know, most recently, for instance, there's a bunch of Food Not Bombs chapters starting in Russia, and they just finished the Russian translation of the Food Not Bombs book. And it's like they've done like all these actions in Moscow, St. Petersburg, and now there's several other smaller cities that have Food Not Bombs chapters. And probably another, in the Islamic world, there's starting to become more Food Not Bombs groups throughout the rest of the Middle East. There's a group starting in Morocco. We have groups in Nigeria. I correspond all the time with the Nigerian Food Not Bombs chapters. And there's a, you know, that's just, who knows, there might be in places that we have no idea where they are. It's just, you know, and I get, and when I hung out with people from Australia most recently in Cancun, they were naming towns in Australia I'd never heard of that had chapters. You know, I'm like, it was like 11 cities or something like that, 11 towns? Yeah, it's like insane. It's and one town in Poland has 12 chapters. You know, like in Warsaw, they have 12 different chapters. And then there's 12 cities in Poland that have chapters. And they're like full-time Food Not Bombs. Like, that's what they do. It's like dozens and dozens of people that just do nothing but Food Not Bombs all day in these towns. And that's what they do. It's pretty remarkable.
And to be really clear, in a lot of those situations, what they're doing is taking direct action. They're just forming collectives and doing what needs to be done to make their lives happen, you know, work. Because not necessarily are they able, free food and collecting food that's surplus and all that is not the same in certain of these countries, but they're still doing some kind of direct action off and around some kind of food service.
Well, actually, I was surprised. In the poorest of countries, we got food really easily.
Yeah?
Yeah, in Belgrade, which is totally the most desolate possible place on earth, we scored food really easily. It was intense. Basically, there's always food being thrown away. It's weird. I was really surprised. And also, in Turkey, which we thought would be hard, it turned out that because it's a Muslim country, when we went to the bazaars to ask for food, they go, "Oh my God, there's people here for food for to feed the hungry." And all the stalls would go, "Oh, here's my food, here's my food." And they'd be like, they're running out in front. And you know, and it's a very poor place, and we were freaking out.
I wasn't meaning to say they weren't doing food. I was saying they were doing additional. They were they were doing political activism as part of the parcel.
Yeah, that's the big thing that they
in a community organizing kind of way.
Right,
that's like what they needed.
Yeah, they because like in Belgrade, it was intense. They did an action that was out in front of the McDonald's on, you know, International Day, protesting McDonald's October 16th, and the people came out of McDonald's to get the flyers. And we're like, "Oh my God, yeah, this place does suck, man. They're ruining our country, man." And these were the customers from McDonald's. And it was a mind blower. And they really think that they're translating the Food Not Bombs book into Croatian and the On Conflict and Consensus into Croatian, because they think that because there's a failed state, that the possibility of Food Not Bombs just flourishing is amazing. In Istanbul, the first day we did Food Not NATO, because NATO was going to be happening in Istanbul. And we decided to go to the first McDonald's, serve outside the first McDonald's in the Arab world, which is or in the Islamic world, which is in Istanbul. And we show up there with all this food and stuff, and there were, I don't know how many, it was like possibly 100 media people showed up. The people couldn't get to the food. And there's like 6-7 TV companies, all these radio stations, newspapers and stuff. And the thing was so intense, and there's all these little kids getting, there's lots of street kids and stuff, and they were trying to get the food and stuff. And so the manager of McDonald's came out, and he had some of the food, and he went back in, and he came out with his workers with trays of Coca-Cola and ice cream for all the kids and stuff, you know, like just giving it away for free to everybody. I was like, what a weird thing. It was intense. Anyway, it's amazing what's going on, and when you get, and from my point of view, I think this huge thing is happening, and it just cannot possibly imagine it would ever be like this soon. Does anybody have any questions? Yeah.
I read the Food Not Bombs.